America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
When the Santa's hell. Live here on this Monday after St. Patrick's Day. Hope all of you out there took a healthy dose of acetaminophen, if there really is such a thing. A little bit of Tylenol, a little bit of ibuprofen, the very, very nice Ranger cocktail. Got yourself squared away. Maybe some of you out there had to have a little morning drink for the hangover that is the day after St. Patrick's Day. But celebrated St. Patrick's Day on this end by watching Kill the Irishman. Story about Danny Green, kind of a unknown film. It didn't do very well in the box office. You know, it had a couple of A-list actors in it, but they only had, you know, brief cameos. Ray Stevenson, who I think is a criminally underrated, was a criminally underrated actor. He was great, just so great in everything that he was in. And, you know, he was playing Danny Green. Danny Green, of course, was a Irish gangster in Cleveland who represented the longshoremen. He got into the labor union rackets in the 1960s into the 1970s, formed, you know, his own Irish mob. And this is kind of traditionally how the mob has went in different areas throughout American history, how, and especially getting into the 20th century, you know, a lot of people wondered how the Italian mafia and the Jewish mafia both kind of really came to strong business prominence, and the Irish mob didn't. And it is kind of interesting how, you know, there's a different dynamic going on there. And I think that has a lot to do with some cultural differences, as much as it is the fact that really the Irish were reliant upon strongmen who were really strong personalities. But then once that went away, there was really no follow on. You know, there was no legacy there. I mean, Whitey Bulger, for example, had never groomed any kind of successor for the Winter Hill Gang. That's just not what he did. He came to power. He was a really brutal guy. And, you know, it and had his operation going on. His crew, the Winter Hill Gang, was very successful, but there was no follow-on there. And it was very similar with Danny Green. Danny Green came to prominence with John Nari, and they were working together. And Nardi, of course, was you know, one of the capo de regimes, or the captains in the Cleveland Mafia, which was really built around labor unions, because Ohio was really big into manufacturing, and so you had the labor union rackets that were going on, as well as running numbers and a large number of other things. Danny Green and his crew provided protection for that originally, and then they realized with the chronic instability that the mafia and organized crime activities had in Cleveland. It was, you know, historically very, very embattled place, and, you know, the Italian families in Cleveland were kind of fighting amongst themselves too. And so Danny Green sought to take advantage of that. It led to an incredibly brutal mob war, a bombing campaign that was going back and forth. They eventually killed him. They killed John Nardi as well. You know, it was a particularly brutal time in mafia history, in American organized crime history. And it's one that I don't think gets explored often enough. I think that they did a really good job with the film. I've seen it a few times. And again, it didn't get a lot of attraction. A lot of the movie critics really didn't like it. Ray Stevenson, I think that he was the perfect guy to play Danny Green. And, you know, Danny Green was in many ways the real life Boondock Saint, and for good and bad. Right. That's not necessarily to praise the guy because, you know, he is a mobster, was a mobster. And, you know, he definitely lived by the sword and died by it. But just an interesting all-around case study in American organized crime. Fascinating piece of history. Fascinating piece of Irish American history as well. You know, outside of Boston and outside of, the Scotch-Irish roots going into the Southeast. It's just very, very interesting. Anyway, while I was watching that and kind of having a quiet evening, unplugging for a little bit, you know, staying out of the stuff, got the heads up that there is once again some instability going on in Cuba, and checked it out once I got a moment, because if you will remember a few years ago, the summer of 2021, in fact, if you will remember a few years ago, there was widespread protests going on across Cuba, and it really looked like there was going to be a color revolution that was unfolding there. You know, I've spoke very negatively about American efforts at regime change, because they have often enough, nearly 100% of the time, been short-sighted and have really worked to the detriment of the targeted populace. If you look at Libya, it didn't do anything for the Libyan people. It didn't do anything for the Egyptian people. It didn't do anything for the Syrians, for sure. They're still in a chronic state of chaos. And you look at who benefited from it. But what I will say is that despite my criticisms that I hurl abroad and looking at things in a strategic sense, you know, we've been tied up in Middle Eastern regimes and the affairs of the Middle East and Europe for much of the 20th century and going into the 21st century, really at America's detriment. And had we followed a stronger Monroe Doctrine here at home and really paid attention to the Western Hemisphere, both North and South, we would have been a lot better off. I don't think that it's necessarily too late to salvage a lot of those relationships, but we are definitely way behind the power curve now, and I don't think that we have the right kind of leadership to capitalize on rebuilding those relationships either, because their interests are way, way too entrenched with things going on in Europe, and you know that's been completely to American detriment. We have too many things going on in the Middle East that we're just still tied up in. The whole Libyan issue was tied to British Petroleum specifically. I mean, there's very strong links there. But with that said, you know, in our absence of leadership in the Southern Hemisphere, China and Russia first, then China, really took the reins and ran with it. They are facing some severe problems. Now, they use a different model of benevolence. They use a different model of intervention. You know, last week, of course, we were talking about Haiti. Haiti is still in incredible dire straits. It's never going to get squared away. And just as I said in the last Sons of Liberty episode, Haiti is certainly a money laundering capital for the most elite out there. That is exactly what it is. You know, nothing more, nothing less. But you know, anyway, with that said, and in saying that, looking at Cuba, there is no more deserving a people of American intervention and guidance. There's no more in all the right ways. There is no more deserving of people than the Cuban people, who have suffered and suffered and suffered and suffered under communist mismanagement and the communist leadership, which has really just absolutely wrecked the island. And, you know, back then, back when we launched Operation Cuba Libre the first time, and you can go back and listen to those episodes, they're way, way back, you know, on AmericanPartisan.org, I had the announcement up, of course, on the forum, we had all that up there. But what we were doing was we were getting on the air in AM mode, in HF, on shortwave radio. We were doing this because in that part of the world, there are a lot of shortwave radios. And shortwave radio, despite its smaller presence here in the United States than in times past, podcasting, the internet, you know, really more, I would say, consistent, simpler methods, simpler in use. Methods of communication have really taken the place of HF and shortwave. And as much as I love shortwave radio, that is a fact. It's really indisputable. But shortwave radio still is huge in impoverished parts of the world. And a lot of people have shortwave radios. And shortwave receives an AM, or amplitude modulation. So in recognizing that fact, with amateur radio, we were transmitting in AM mode so that they would be received on the shortwave radio frequencies and they would be able to receive our traffic clearly. When you're in lower sideband or upper sideband, there's going to be some compression there. It's going to sound a little garbled. I mean, depending on the bandwidth, it could come in clearly. But usually it doesn't. There's some sort of detrimental effect in there. So we were transmitting on AM. And this is when things were really hot and heavy. And, you know, the populist fight looked like it was going to the direction of the protesters. And we were transmitting information to them. We were coordinating activities based on what we were seeing. And so this was a way to facilitate flash mob activities over the air, over radio. And we were doing that with the Radio Recon Group. So this go around, it seems like, according to my contacts that I have, it seems like a lot of the shortwave radios in Cuba have been either taken away, confiscated, because they have very strict control over means of communication there. But they've been taken away and they've been replaced with other more, quote-unquote, simpler means for the people. Smartphones. The distribution of smartphones has been one of the big factors in that. And they receive government broadcasts over their smartphones. So that should tell you something as well as there are approved messaging apps, and then there are the no-no ones. But anyhow, with all that said, stricter level of governmental control, and radio in recognizing that AM radio, shortwave radio, really is a voice of the outside world coming in. They were taking those radio transmitters and radio receivers, rather, and taking those up. So this go around, I'm monitoring the situation closely, and I want to dive a little bit deeper into this. So some videos were coming out. They had come out, it's my understanding, because there were some people who asked some valid questions about these videos. How did they get out if there's such a strict level of control? How did this video get out? There are ways. There are absolutely ways. And it is my understanding that this video got out through WhatsApp, which WhatsApp is allowed on the Cuban telecommunications and cell phone networks. It is one of the approved messaging apps because it can be monitored in real time. But this video did indeed get out. And what it is in the town of Bayamo. So Bayamo, if you're not familiar with the topography of Cuba, Bayamo is in the Sierra Maestra Mountains. Near, pulling up the map here, Santa Teresa, Santiago, which is down by the coastline, the southern coastline of Cuba, down towards Guantanamo Bay. Guantanamo Bay is, you know, all the way in the far southeastern corner. Bayamo is kind of, you see that small corner of the island still in the southern peninsula here. Bayamo is kind of on the western end of that. You can pull it up. And again, I'm looking at the roads here. Highway 152 and Highway 342 and Highway 4 all run into it. But little topography there. The people are really, really upset, crying out, freedom, freedom, freedom. And you know, they are really, really unhappy with the situation that has been afforded to them. Imagine that. You have all these American communists. You have all these academics. You have all these idiot know-nothings that are out there that are literally taking the greatest country ever in the history of mankind, the greatest living standard ever in the history of mankind, and they're literally wanting to burn it all down. Meanwhile, you have people who are living under the boot of communism right now, and look at what they're doing. Look at they're crying out for freedom. That's what they want. Americans take what they have been handed, and they will gladly hand it away. They know absolutely not what they're asking for. And that's why we can look to the people just to our south and sympathize 100% with them, because they've lived through it. They suffered through it. They know exactly what it is. And that's why when you get these people that come to the United States and they look around, how could you want to throw that away? How could you want to throw this away? It's absolute insanity. But so from a contact who shall remain nameless, but has experience on the ground in Cuba, and I'm going to decline to go any further than that. But in speaking to them, you know, we got a little bit better insight. The protests are over food distribution and electricity. The Cuban government is broadcasting the protests over state-run TV, which is said that this is very rare. The Policía Nacional de Revolución, all right, so this is the Cuban state police, or the national police of the revolution. You know, you always have that. You have the, you know, in Iran, for example, you have the formal party line towers that makes sure that the populace stays in line with the political party agenda. It's exactly what this is. But they've been patrolling, but there's a larger presence of Policia Municipal, which is the local police. So you're not getting as much of the national police, but the local police. The protests are regionalized to Santiago, Bayamo, and Hologuin. The internet is being ratioed, meaning they're shutting off the bandwidth to people. But most social media seems to be all right, and we will be kept up to date. President Canal is insinuating that terrorists and outside agitators, along with local hooligans, are responsible. The protests are peaceful, but they are loud. So, kind of an inside look, you know, getting up to date on what's going on there. And, you know, again, the people are very upset with the government because their basic quality of life and their needs are not being met. So, looking over at what Cuban state media is saying about this, they do have this as a top story on Cuban state media. Cuban president denounces destabilizing attempts from the United States. Of course, they're going to be blaming the U.S. for this. Havana, March 17th. Prensa Latina, which is the Latin press, one of the state media agencies. Cuban president Miguel Díaz-Canel has denounced the terrorist groups based in the United States are encouraging actions against the country's internal order, taking advantage of the difficult situation the Caribbean island is going through. The Cuban president reported that people have expressed their dissatisfaction with the deficit in the national electric service and the distribution of food. This context is being exploited by enemies of the Cuban Revolution for destabilizing purposes, the president explained on the social network X, formerly known as Twitter. Díaz-Canel pointed out that in the last few hours, we've seen terrorists based in the United States, whom we have denounced on repeated occasions, are encouraging actions against the internal order of our country. In this regard, Díaz-Canel said that the disposition of the authorities of the Communist Party of Cuba, the state, and the government is to attend to the demands of our people, listen, dialogue, explain the numerous steps being taken to improve the situation, always in an atmosphere of tranquility. The Cuban president reaffirmed that in the midst of the conditions of the U.S. blockade that is trying to suffocate us, we will continue working in peace to get out of this situation. That is a lie. That is a bold-faced lie, and that is a lie that the Communist Party of Cuba has used over and over and over again to lie to the entire world. There is a trade embargo between the United States and Cuba, but Cuba can very much trade with the rest of the world. Canada being one of those countries, by the way. And I don't say that because the leader of Canada kind of looks like the son of the historic leader of Cuba. Contemporary Cuba, by the way. No, it's not what I mean by that. Although that is funny whenever you bring that up. Because he does. If you look at him, he certainly does. Point is, though, the point is here. Is that this is a lie. They can't meet the demands of their people because communism incentivizes the lazy to get entrenched into positions to which you can never get rid of them. They are parasites. Any communist is a parasite. We see this in the United States. Affirmative action, DEI. You can't get rid of these people. Name me one place where a DEI hiree has achieved anything worthwhile or contributed to that organization. Don't worry, I'll wait. We all know it. If you've worked in any organization where this has happened, you've seen it. You've seen it. I mean, this is what communism is. And they're all communists, by the way. These are all communist programs because they're brought about to create equity. Right? Equity. equality of outcome. We're not all equal. That's a lie. We're not all equal. Some of us are better at some things than others. Not everybody can build a business from the ground up. Multiple businesses, by the way. Not everybody can start a podcast that consistently is in the top 10 of podcasts on multiple podcasting platforms. Not everybody can start a training company from the ground up. I've seen a lot of people come and go on shoestring budgets. I've seen a lot of people come and go. There's a lot of things I'm not good at. There's a lot of things other people are not good at. We're not all equal. Equality of opportunity is not the equality of outcome. And that is also what they don't mean when they say equity or creating equity or restorative justice. These are all language cues that the social Marxists here in the United States, who have gained control of the institutions, by the way, this is what they say. And it's very funny to me. That we have no better example of its failures, continuous failures, than just to our south. So, for her part, the story goes on. For her part, the first secretary of the Communist Party of Cuba in Santiago de Cuba, Beatriz Johnson. That's an interesting name for whatever. Published a statement on Sunday on her X account. All these Cuban government officials are on Twitter. I might have to check this out. I had no idea. She said that a group of people expressed their dissatisfaction in front of the headquarters of the Executive Directorate of District 3 of Santiago de Cuba Municipality. The complaints centered on the imbalance of electrical power supply blocks and the distribution of food, particularly milk. You know, that's interesting because what we've heard from the green energy crowd, what we've heard from the green weenies, the people in all over Europe, the World Economic Forum crowd, is we got to reduce the number of cattle out there, right? We got to reduce the number of cows. You will eat the bugs and you will like it. You will eat these bugs. We'll do this. Look at this. It's right there, right? This is what centralized agriculture does. This is what centralized management does. This is what it does. Because it's not the competent, by the way. I want to point something out here again. It's not the competent that get into the managerial positions. Because there is rampant nepotism among them. It's not the competent that end up there. The incompetent end up there. The people who can't make it in the private sector are the ones who end up there. Because if they could make it in the private sector, they'd be in the private sector. And they would be railing against the public sector because they're sick of paying their paychecks. Anyhow. In response to these concerns, the secretary reported that the partial distribution of the basic food basket, we're going to determine what you need, right? That's what this is. We're going to determine what you need to each according to their means, to each according to their needs, right? This is a great tenet of Marxism. We're going to creating equity across the board, right? Which include 3 pounds of rice and 4 pounds of sugar is currently underway. 3 pounds of rice for what? For what amount of time? Because 3 pounds of rice is not a whole lot of rice, and for how many people, they conveniently leave that one out too. In addition, a large mobilization of local leaders is being carried out. Local leaders who were picked by us and were brought in from another part of the island so that you don't know who they are and you don't have a familiar relationship with them. That's how that works. It's how you manage people internally, right? You shift people around, you move them around. Learned that one from the army, which is also a socialist organization. Now that these resources are available to them, now that they are available to them, why weren't they available before? Because you didn't have it. Because it was a failure. It's a continuous failure, right? So anyway, rounding this one out, the secretary also highlighted the respectful attitude of the population of Santiago de Cuba, who listened attentively to the information provided by the municipality's leadership regarding the distribution of the basic food basket and milk. Likewise, the situation of the electric power supply was explained, which is affected by the problems faced by the thermoelectric power plants and the availability of fuel. So what about green energy? What about all that? What about the, you know, these green energy initiatives? So that's obviously not working. That stuff's obviously not working. Period. End of story. Okay, end of story. And so going back to this video here where the Communist Party officials were run to the roof of their commissar headquarters, their local Politburo headquarters. So people are really upset with them. You know, and at this point, it's not about power. Okay, it's not about all of that. It's the totality of the fact that their basic quality of life is not being met. You know, I've said it over and over again in class. I explain Sweat MC. Sewer, water, electricity, access, all right, access to all the above. When you have inequality of access to basic qualities of life, you know, people are going to get a little upset about it. Transportation, medical care, and then communications. Sweat MC. So I say again, sewer, water, electricity, access to all the above, transportation, medical care, and communications. Those seven pillars are what you need to provide to a place. If those are not being provided for, then the government is failing in its duty to its people, and it's running the risk of being overthrown. Then again, that's also seven steps on how to be a warlord. If you want to remain in power, you have to provide all of those things. And so we have a perfect example of that here. They can't provide consistent electricity. They're failing in their fundamental duties, and so they're having issues. Now keep that in mind. You know, a lot of people are really concerned, and rightfully so. I get a lot of emails about this, of, you know, the people who are coming across the border, and which absolutely is an invasion, and we're going to be talking about that more in upcoming episodes. Things are getting a lot more dangerous out there, but singularly, chaos kind of can be contained. It is an annoyance, but it's something that will get tamped down eventually, one way or another, despite how dramatic it might be. Of course, you don't want to get caught in that. That's why you shouldn't be living in a city. But at the big picture scale, it ends up fizzling itself out, and it gets fixed one way or another. It does take time for this to happen. But my concern about who's coming across the border is their ability to organize and how organized they already are. Because when you have organization, you have the ability to target infrastructure. When you have the ability to target infrastructure, you think about things in terms of Sweat MC, because Sweat MC is what gets targeted. Okay, if you want to discredit a government, that's what you have to attack. That's what you have to bring down, is one of those things to destabilize a place, whatever it is. All right. And so when that happens, of course, another arm of your organization, the political organization arm of your organization, has to be ready to step in to cause the riots to begin. Because the real role of riots And I say this as a conflict theory sociologist. At one point in time in my life, that was my academic discipline. And conflict theory sociology is rooted in Marxism, by the way. It is a Marxian academic path that you are on, where you understand that conflict in society is rooted in inequalities, right, wherever they are. And so it was a very natural area of study for me, coming out of conflict in the Middle East and, you know, obviously Iraq and Afghanistan, and being a student of that, being a participant in that. That kind of gave me a certain perspective on it. So I understand all of this stuff, right? Riots, according to the left, are the language of the unheard. But where that fits into the broader spectrum of things is there has to be follow-up activities that ensure some sort of political goal, right? That creates some sort of tangible political goal. This is why protests and all that stuff really don't work on the right, because they don't have anything that follows it up. This is just blow-off valve. You know, Charlottesville's blow-off valve. Lobby Day, blow-off valve. January 6th was a big blow-off valve. And it's funny because each of these things were a vehicle that was used later on by the left that they targeted, that the media targeted, and it created a very tangible goal for them. Despite my warnings, the warnings of a handful of other people, hey, you know, you want to steer clear of that because we know what it is. There is no long-term objective. If there's a long-term objective involved in that, then yeah. But the right has yet to recognize that. And, you know, until they do, this is kind of where we sit. But anyway, with that said, it's the organizational capacity of the people who are coming over the border, right? That they target these pieces of infrastructure. Again, sewer, water, electricity, access to all of the above, transportation, medical care, and communications. They begin to cause active disruptions to those things. That's when you know that problems are inbound, and quickly. Very quickly. So going back to Operation Cuba Libre, and of course Venezuela, the Venezuelan uprising, the soldiers in flannel shirts, that conflict that happened, where did that go sideways? Where did all those things go sideways? What happened there? Why did it fail? It failed because the United States did not have the will to do what was necessary to get to see it out, to continue it further. Much like Bay of Pigs, you know, the E. Howard Hunt wrote Give Us This Day, and I have that book. I have a copy of it at the G Camp. You know, it's laying around in there. Kind of a forgotten about book, a very obscure book, but E. Howard Hunt was the man who was tasked with putting together everything that went into Bay of Pigs. And so its failure, that was a firsthand account of everything that they did, the planning, the training, everything that went into that and why it failed. Specifically why it failed and the events that transpired leading up to its failure. You know, E. Howard Hunt became a pariah, and you know, the Watergate show that they made with Woody Harrelson, which was just terrible. It was terrible. I watched it until the last episode, and then I didn't even finish the last episode. It was awful. It was really, really awful. They made G. Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt look like complete imbeciles, complete buffoons. And that wasn't what happened at all. Howard Hunt was very intelligent. He just didn't make friends with the right people, because he was willing to call a spade, and knew that in the post-World War II era, there were a lot of socialists in our intelligence apparatus, especially in the State Department. And he called a spade a spade. that was a hit piece that they put out. That show was absolutely awful. And G. Gordon Liddy was, you know, they made him look like a completely unhinged lunatic. Now, the man was a wild man. I'll give him that. And he definitely was willing to go the distance for God and country. And I'll give him that. And a lot of the things that he said might have been miscategorized as something else. But let me tell you something. That guy was a true patriot. The G-Man was a legend. And he was a brilliant thinker. There were very, very few left or right that could touch him intellectually. And that was widely known. And if you don't believe me, go look up. These are still out there. These tapes are still out there. Go look up his discourses that he did with Timothy Leary when he got out of prison from Watergate. If you want to see a razor sharp mind juxtaposed to a drug addled mind, the G-Man, G. Gordon Liddy. And so that show was just really, really awful. But anyway, all that aside, where I'm going with this is that to understand why those color revolutions, those social revolutions, I feel like we use color revolution a lot, but the United States did coin the term, and that is our playbook. It's what we do. We've been doing it for a long period of time. It's nothing new. Victoria Nuland didn't invent it. She's just not very good at it. I guess if self-enrichment is the game, then maybe she is pretty good at it. But if that's not the game, anyway, that's morbid joke aside, because, man, wow, she's just grotesque. What a grotesque person. But anyhow, in Venezuela and in Cuba, and likely several other places, Colombia is probably on the horizon. We're going to have to deal with Colombia at some point. Brazil probably as well. As their ties get more and more deeply entrenched with the Chinese Communist Party. Nicaragua is another one. As this continues, and Nicaragua is very, very far down the line for a lot of reasons. Daniel Ortega has kind of made peace with understanding what economic necessities need to be there, what needs to be present for a populace not to turn on you. He definitely learned some lessons from his time as the president of the Sandinistas. But anyhow, that's a whole other piece of history. We were not willing to go the distance. We were not willing to capitalize on causing chaos against the sweat MC, right? Against the pillars of stability. We were not willing to do that. We didn't do that. And they weren't targeted because I think that we assumed on whatever level, whoever was tasked with planning this, there was probably an assumption that was made that, well, the people are unhappy because those factors are already in play. There is a lack of electricity. There is a lack of access, of the equality of access. There is inconsistent transportation. They probably looked at it that way. But despite that, when these things become normalized, the lack of electricity becomes normalized in many parts of the world. That's just the way that it goes. Iraq was a very good example of that. Power rationing is a regular thing. It's going to happen. But we incorrectly made an assumption that, well, that's just always going to happen. Rather than shutting down the power plants and totes, right? Rather than throwing a wrench in the system, rather than disrupting the ability to have mass transit and consistent transportation, rather than cutting communications in totes, which we absolutely can do. Absolutely. Aside from HF, aside from shortwave radio, you can attempt to jam that, but you can't do it consistently. But other means, the internet, you can control that. You can shut that off. Cell phones, you can shut that off. Phones, telephones, you can shut that off. Radio is the one thing that you cannot shut down. Completely, by the way, completely. Especially pirate radio. We're going to be talking about that. It's, a lot's going to go into that in the upcoming Gorilla's Guide to HF, which is a working title. It's not necessarily going to be the final title, but we're going to be talking about all those things. You know, it's just like with the other Gorilla's Guides to Baofeng Radio, Gorilla's Guide to Signals Intelligence. You know, I'm not telling you just how to use equipment. I'm explaining the theory of use and kind of thinking outside of the box on all these things. But, you know, with that said, we weren't real willing to go the distance. We weren't willing to go to the distance in Venezuela. And, you know, I lay the blame on that squarely at the feet of Nikki Haley. With Nikki Haley, we could point 100,000 other failures at her. Lots of other things. You know, she's a neocon, and you can say what you want, but that failure, the failure in Venezuela and the failure in Colombia, in neighboring Colombia, is squarely at her feet from incompetence. And that those two things have wrecked American foreign policy in South America through her incompetence, singularly. Her incompetence. She was tasked. She was the person that was in charge with that. And so in Cuba, when we fast forward just a bit, in Cuba, she was still, her policies were still at work, and it folded up because the American government, once more, was not willing to do what needed to be done to help the people through a true populist revolt. And it's my intuition that just like with the Bay of Pigs invasion, the color revolution failed in Cuba because the Democrats had to placate their communist base. The exact same as then is what it is now. Because if communism in Cuba fails, then the ideology that is the root of the Democrat Party, the modern Democrat Party, and always was a faction of the Democrat Party, going back at least to Woodrow Wilson, if not further, would be proven false right on its face. And they can't allow that. They cannot allow its failures. They cannot allow the failures of socialism. Because if that fails and that's wrong, then everything that they have argued for is also wrong. And they will never be willing to admit it. So, you know, I'll be praying for the people in Cuba. We are going to mobilize another Operation Cuba Libre, Operation Cuba Libre 2.0. I will have the details as we are going into the weekend. This is going to be a very, very busy week. Going towards the weekend, seeing how this plays out. If the demonstrations become more widespread, I think that it's interesting that they are broadcasting this on Cuban state media. They're probably trying to get ahead of the protests. If I had to guess, that is what my very good intuition of these types of situations. That's what my very good intuition is telling me. But anyhow, with that said, I'm going to be praying for them. We are going to be doing something in response to this. So all of you amateur radio operators out there, all you guys with your radio equipment, you really want to mobilize. You really want to figure out how all of this stuff works and become a force for good. We're going to be doing it. We're going to be mobilizing. I'm going to be talking about this going later into the week. Depending on how this pans out, if this one fizzles and it doesn't look like it's going to get a lot of support and the people kind of die down for right now, then you know, we're going to be standing down with a radio recon group. But if it looks like it's picking up and we're going to be monitoring it very closely, then we're going to be there to provide that support. So anyway, with that said, get over to brushbeater.store. Got hit hard this weekend, and I'm grinning from ear to ear. Sold a lot of radios, sold a lot of thermal, sold a lot of optics. We are really rocking and rolling. And, you know, y'all are taking advantage of it. And it's really cool to see it. You know, it is really, really cool to see it. It is really great to be afforded that opportunity to be able to provide prepared, armed, free people of the United States, our free people out there, and the people who value liberty with great equipment. Anyway, folks, it has been a heck of an episode. Again, I hope nobody's too hungover from St. Patrick's Day yesterday. Of course, we've got a lot of other really fun holidays coming up. And we're going to have a lot of great episodes coming up in the near future as well. A lot of awesome projects on tap. And I can't wait to unveil one of them that we've been working very hard behind the scenes, but not quite ready to announce it to the public yet. But when we do, I'm telling you, it's going to be big. Folks, God bless. Stay safe out there. Keep your heads on a swivel, and I will talk to you again very, very soon. This is NC Scout, out.